welcome to Playwright, a podcast about creating and sharing new ways to play. My name is Ryan Heyman. You can call me H.
And I'm Ryan Quintel. You can call me Q. God, I had to ask that like a question. Huh?
Is that my name any longer?
My brain is very fried today, but I feel
the same way. I'm a little bit more low energy than I usually am, which is not a tremendously high bar to begin with. I'm not, you know, I would not be a suitable TV personality, let's say.
I know. It makes you really wonder how the daily, you know, or nightly hosts get up for their job every day. It's actually kind of unbelievable.
I guess, yeah, we don't have anything more to say about that. That's another symptom of the disease of tiredness.
Yes. Oh my God. It's been a long week, but thank you for inviting me to watch the Star Wars Holiday Special.
That's right. This was your first time sitting through the legendary Star Wars Holiday Special. What was your takeaway impression?
Yeah, it seems like, gosh, if Star Wars was George Lucas getting into weed, then this is him getting into PCP or something, or LSD. There were so many trippy sequences. And I don't know if they ended up that way because just because of how television budgets are and the way that television has to achieve its effects, but clearly kind of shocking, to be honest with you.
I mean, there was some real talent involved there. You know, some people, I mean, they, Art Carney, Harvey Korman, the group that would go on to become Cirque du Soleil, like there's a, you know, a lot of genuinely talented people involved, but it's just, I guess it goes to show that you can have all the talents in the world and still come away with something that altogether doesn't make sense if you don't, you know, structure it, if you don't curate it appropriately.
Yeah. And I do think like it, you said it was canon, right?
Yeah. That's like it was definitely a part of the old canon. And then when the canon was reset, when Disney bought it, everyone was kind of like, oh, well, that means that the holiday special is definitely gone. But ever since then, many, many creators in the new Disney canon have gone out of their way to reaffirm aspects of the holiday special, whether it's specific characters or whether it's just Life Day in general, which has been mentioned numerous times in the new Disney canon. So yeah, there's a, I feel like it's pretty safe to say that what you saw on screen is and is going to remain a vital piece of Star Wars lore.
Yeah, I it's just shocking. I know, I'm sorry, I'm so tired, but boy, oh boy, I by the end of it, thank God we watched it with some like meta humor injected into it with the riff tracks, because I wouldn't have made it. I wouldn't have made it otherwise. But it warmed my cockles.
It is, yeah. I mean, I spent this time around watching and kind of like on another screen doing like research into the deep lore of the characters, which is surprising how much has been written about these one-off, you know, bit characters in the time since. But there's some that apparently have, you know, a fairly large following of fans. Beatrice Arthur's Akmina character is one that has a substantial amount of lore from multiple books and different types of sources associated with it. So yeah, I mean, leave it up to the Star Wars fans to take things farther than you ever expected them to go.
Do you think Disney is going to try and redo this special? I know you mentioned there's like a Lego sequel.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is like, I think there's a lot of demand for the special to be released in a way that isn't a bootleg VHS, you know?
Like, yeah.
Obviously, we were watching a fairly low quality version of it, and
it was
there's
perfect.
A certain charm to that. I love watching the commercials in between the segments and everything, but I would love to see like a proper, you know, Blu-ray transfer of this. And Disney has it in their hands. They know that they can do it. They've been dancing around it for a long time. I feel like it's only a matter of time until the true, you know, Star Wars Holiday Special can be watched in high definition through Disney Plus.
Yeah. And we'll get to see who's underneath some of that Wookiee makeup. That'll be a sight.
Yeah. Anyways, that's a yearly tradition that I've done for the past like 13 years or so. Every November 17th, we celebrate Life Day, which is the anniversary of the original and only airing of the Star Wars Holiday Special. So if anybody out there would like to join us next year, I feel like the streaming format worked pretty well. We did it remotely this time around, obviously because of COVID. So yeah, just kind of invited a few people on Discord and yeah, just kind of streamed it from there. It seemed to work pretty handily. So good format. Looks like a pretty decent way to do it going forward as well. So yeah, I guess get in touch around next November and just kind of see what we're up to. Always like to do something bigger and better than last year to celebrate Life Day.
I hope that I can be a part of all of your life days to come, H.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you're not scared off from it. There's, I should say, this is probably not very good radio. This is probably not going to mean anything to anyone who hasn't seen the show, but several of my friends that I got into, you know, that I introduced the Star Wars Holiday Special to back in college have since gone on to collect some pretty nice Life Day memorabilia. One of my friends owns a record single of Light the Sky on Fire by the Jefferson Starship.
Whoa.
Which is famously the song that they performed in Art Carney's musical box. He also owns a Tobor, which he got off of eBay. And it looks just like the one in the commercial. So, yeah, Tobor being robot spelled backwards. Pretty exciting eBay find, I would say.
Holy cannoli.
I always like to bring out the red graduation robes. And last year I upgraded with a pretty decent Chewbacca mask. So I get the whole Life Day outfit going on.
That's incredible. Oh my God. Yeah, hey, listen, I'm not above dressing up for Life Day. It just has to be the right the right moment.
Anyways, let's get to some video game pitches.
Do we have to
go first today? What are you bringing to the table?
So I correct me if I'm wrong, but this episode airs on Thanksgiving.
That sounds right. Yeah.
So I wanted to pitch. I've got two little ideas, and I maybe they're compatible, maybe they're not. But one of them is an Overcooked mode or a new Overcooked spinoff game where you are multiple chefs preparing a Thanksgiving meal, one cohesive Thanksgiving meal for a family on Thanksgiving. And then the second idea that maybe is related and maybe is very strange and adjacent is something to do with either arranging food or very strange objects in a cornucopia. Slightly incoherent pitch today, but maybe one of these things or both of them are interesting in their own way.
Let's go ahead and start the clock there then. There's a game that I've played a little bit of called Cooking Simulator. Do you know that one?
I've never played it, but I have heard of it.
I'd say a great way to be introduced to it. There's a YouTube channel called Let's Game It Out that did three, I think, excellent videos about Cooking Simulator. It's basically like they kind of set you up in what looks like a, not quite a commercial kitchen. It looks like a TV set of a kitchen in a way. Like it's very, you know, it's very large, very expansive. You have all the things that you need. You have multiple of everything that you need, like multiple ovens, burners, deep fryers, cutting board spaces. Like
it's very well rendered.
Yeah, yeah. It looks quite nice. And basically you have all of the ingredients and you have recipes that you follow and you have to go kind of step by step to prepare all of these different recipes. And there's a level of jankiness involved because, you know, it's not Surgeon Simulator where the controls are kind of taking the piss, but like it definitely knows that the level of fidelity that you're getting with the controls is not one-to-one with like actually, you know, cooking in real life. So it is fairly forgiving, and it does allow you to pretty royally mess things up, but still, like, you can, like, drop food on the floor, pick it up, put it on the plate, and it's still okay. Like, you know, it doesn't penalize you for cutting things into weird shapes, you know? There is a VR version as well, which I haven't played yet, and I'm really interested in that, though. But apparently, I would think that would kind of, you know, even render those one-to-one fidelity issues kind of moot at that point, because you are actually performing the actions to cook these foods. But
now, correct me if I'm wrong, but this, from what I'm seeing of Cooking Simulator, it seems like you're all alone. Maybe this is like maybe just multiplayer itself on top of something like this is a bit of a twist.
Yeah. Actually, the aspect of this that I wanted to bring into it is, that I wanted to reference from this game, is that at the end of preparing the meal, you are basically kind of placing all of your food on the plate. You go to walk it over to a window and serve it up, just kind of like an Overcooked almost. But since everything is a physics object, like you do have to be, you have to kind of individually place all of the items, or you can just kind of dump it onto a plate and see how much of the recipe ends up remaining on the plate. You have to kind of be careful as you carry it over. Like, and then it gives you, like, as you're serving it up, kind of a close-up view of your meal, almost like a food photographer. That seems like such an interesting part of the mix, is like the plating of it. Like, if there was a game that was mostly about the plating and arranging versus the actual cooking, like, that's kind of a interesting way to take this. And I don't know if I've fully seen that yet. We've seen plenty of Overcooked and Cook Serve Delicious that are all about kind of preparing food and operating under, you know, the ingredients and preparing the ingredients, combining the ingredients. But I've never seen plating being given much attention.
Yeah.
Like, what can we do to make that aspect of it maybe even a central focus? Because I think well-presented food is definitely an art in of itself.
And there's a lot when you see, like, a restaurant have somebody that's quickly plating things or about to send it out to customers, you'll see, like, a chef go to wipe the plate so that there's no, like, spare food debris or drizzle or anything like that. But this, it's, I think that sort of level of thoughtfulness and detail would be cool to capture. There's also certain rules. I don't know if they're even rules, but, like, things like height, for example, height looks very impressive on a plate. So you can kind of dump spaghetti into a thing, but if you can twist the spaghetti into, you know, a nest around a central fork or something, you get something that's far more pleasing to look at and even bountiful looking as it shows up on a plate. So I think that there is kind of, like, you could have some rating on, like, height, neatness. You could do things like give somebody a spoon so they have, like, a physics-y mud displacement to do, like, puree spreads and that sort of thing.
Yeah, this kind of trying to get things as high as possible, it's almost kind of like a Mount Your Friends type of scenario where you're just trying to, you know, work against the physics that want to kind of keep it crashing down.
Oh, do you think that there's, like, a Thanksgiving angle to be had here? Like, maybe a, you know, you're at a Thanksgiving food or food is being served and you have to get as many ingredients and as much as the ingredients on your plate as possible. So you're just faced with different buffet scenarios and you have to figure out, like, what order to stack and smash the food to get the most calories on your plate.
It would be kind of funny. It's kind of like an all you can eat type of place.
I love it because we could recreate the world's best buffets, H. We could do the Pizza Hut buffet. We could do the Wendy's salad bar. Does anybody remember that? Or you know, a grocery store salad bar. Who doesn't love going to that thing and just filling that stupid tin can full of iceberg lettuce?
I was at a Wendy's once, and on the window, there was one of those decals advertising some of its new meals. And this one was advertising the salads, and it had the tagline, redefining fresh, which I always thought was, like, I'm pretty comfortable with the current definition of fresh. I don't really want a lot of elbow room being added to that definition. Like,
no,
let's stick with fresh and see if we can redefine some other words. Thank you very much. I don't know if I want to leave a fast food giant to redefine what fresh food means.
Yeah, you generally don't want to recast the definition of anything that is positive. I think about it. Oh my God, that is too funny. I often said that, like, Subway's slogan should be Subway, eat food. because it's not, you're not always getting the high quality stuff there.
Question mark at the end of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Subway eat cake, apparently.
And pizza. Remember they had pizza for a while? Oh, man, I do. You could do something where, I know we're a little bit off the cooking and the preparation of it, but to that cornucopia idea, the cornucopia is such a strange shape, you know, packing it densely with fruit or food or whatever. You'd really want to start with stuff that is going to fit when it's smaller and then really kind of go up in scale. So it's kind of a job of arranging food by size. And I imagine you'd get something very similar with the plate loading simulator, the buffet simulator, where you got to first kind of scope everything at the buffet. Maybe you got to butt in and cut people so that you can get to things like the mashed potatoes first. So you've got a nice solid foundation there that'll pick up all the frozen peas.
So there's kind of a time pressure as well as the calorie. So this would be most fun as kind of a competitive type of thing. Four players simultaneously,
yeah,
each kind of trying to race around to get the optimal tower. And perhaps you can kind of interfere with your competitors' towers of food in a way, maybe not directly. Like, I don't know if I want somebody to just go over and use their hand to swat away the entire tower that we built. This seems too easy. Not enough risk for how much reward it's giving the other player, but like, you know, maybe they can jostle
you. Well, if you take all the bacon bits, they can't have any.
Yeah, right? Okay, fair. I mean, you could just kind of, you know, every ingredient you get, you could just kind of dump the rest on the floor, but that hardly seems fairer, sporting. It doesn't seem competitive. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it has to be some combination of, I wonder if you do like most calories, least food, but like your plate very much has to be a physics object. So if you do like go heavy with the gravy, it's, you must, maybe you lose points for doing things like making a mess, or if you're at a, you know, buffet tray and you scoop up baby carrots and some of them fall into the broccoli. These are all kind of terrible examples, but you get the idea. If you're kind of making a mess with the food, you get like a point deduction there. So you're constantly trying to balance like being very neat, doing it relatively quickly. So there's this like pressure for precision, but also you get to, maybe you get to walk, do one loop around the buffet once, so you can kind of plan out what ingredients you're going to start with. And then you start at one side of the buffet and there's those two plates at the very end, and you get to choose whether or not you're going to circle clockwise or counterclockwise at the buffet. And if you choose the direction that most people aren't going, you're like delayed or something, as they're like, oh, what's this jerk doing going counterclockwise?
Okay, we have spent our 10 minutes. Let's wrap it up. Let's give it a name.
What would we call like a buffet glutton? Like, maybe this is just all you can eat.
One thing I was thinking of, this is a very far reach even for us, was war in buffet.
That
would look like Warren Buffett if you were to just read it, but it expresses the competitive nature of eating at a buffet.
War-in, is that what you're doing? Or war space
war
in?
War in buffet. So it's kind of like a, you know, war and peace type of thing.
Or are you talking about like, maybe it's warring? W-A-R-I-N-G?
No, W-A-R-R-I-N-G.
Oh, R-R-R.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's, I think that
it's still the same
gets
spirit.
The same. Or we could do kind of an I-N apostrophe to, you know, Warren.
Warren.
Warren Buffet.
Congratulations, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving. The show's hit an all-time low. I hope you're listening to this on an empty stomach, because I imagine us talking about food.
No, I hope you're listening to this around the Thanksgiving table with your family.
Hey, put this on for Grandma. Look, we're going to send a little message to Grandma right now. She's going to think it's a different show. Here we go. So I really think these video games, you know, they're not safe for our children. They're not good for culture, and we have to do things to stop them.
Yeah, no, Matlock was just telling me the exact same thing. So if you can't trust him, then who can you trust?
Amen.
Anyways, I think that'll... do it for that one.
I'm punchy today. I'm sorry.
Let's go on over to our second pitch of the day, less food oriented. So maybe this would be a good opportunity for your entire family to move over to the dessert phase, kind of let things digest for a little bit.
Yeah.
This isn't a game in as much as it is a peripheral piece of hardware, something that I've thought a lot about ever since the GameCube, actually. The GameCube really kind of made an impression on me because of its weird arrangement of buttons on the controller. And, you know, I would love seeing the GameCube controller button layout represented on screen, like in Wind Waker, like, you know, just the fact that like all the buttons were so differently shaped and positioned, like it just made the, anytime that it gave kind of an on-screen button prompt, it just made it that much more readable. It's been a long time since I played with a GameCube controller. I don't know if in the modern age, it would be what I would prefer necessarily. But like, I think that there are some titles that it definitely did a lot to benefit. You know, you always kind of hear in retrospect after each console generation goes by that there's a few games that really take advantage of or really benefit from the way that a controller was laid out. You know, Mario 64 on the N64 pad and that kind of thing. And Halo on the original Duke controller. There's still people that swear by that, by the original Xbox controller. But
those black and white buttons.
Yeah, right. What I thought was like, wouldn't it be neat if there was a controller that could somehow change button layouts depending on the game? And I don't know exactly how that would work, but I feel like we can get there. And I just wanted to kind of leave that open as our pitch today and see what kind of interesting adaptable controller, what type of controller we could create. So I'm going to start the clock there and see what happens.
One of the things looking back at the GameCube, it was so smartly designed in a number of ways, but specifically on the controller, what I think is truly wonderful, a lot of people don't think of, I think, in controller design now, is the GameCube controller did something automatically for someone that a game didn't have to do, which is have a very strong default button, you know? So when in doubt on a GameCube controller, pressing the big fat green A in the middle of there, you knew you were probably going to get, you know, pretty good chance of the correct result that you were looking for. Then it treated B as kind of like smaller and secondary, like, okay, mostly A, a little bit of B, and then flanking A were these two special buttons. And so, like, I remember playing, for example, was Resident Evil 4? Didn't that have a GameCube release?
Right, that was the original console for Resident Evil 4.
Wow, that's kind of wild to think about. It would work so brilliantly in that game because that game really had a lot of context buttons of like suddenly a, you know, a quick time sequence, or you know, you would stun a zombie and you'd have to go quickly kick them, and you know, A, the big button is the one that you push to do it. And so I'm wondering if there's a technology or something that could almost like a gel on the right hand side of the controller, and it could kind of become raised and stiffer in spots to create different button layouts or something for each game. Like I imagine in Assassin's Creed, the parkour button is going to be like that main button there.
One of the things that I thought about, you know, as far as like a changeable button layout, which seems impossible because, you know, the buttons are solid pieces of plastic with, you know, in their own kind of holes in another solid piece of plastic. You know, it doesn't seem like you should be able to move those around. But like, what if controllers were more like, I wish I knew the name of this toy, but you know, it's like that that board of needles that you can push on one side and see kind of an imprint of your hand on the other. So there was some sort of like a,
yes,
you know, more kind of intricate mechanisms underneath that can kind of push the like needles upwards, and then maybe those can kind of like push against like a gel cover for the entire controller. And you know, maybe that could even like in the thinking about future technology, not thinking about affordability of controllers necessarily, but like that could be one of those like foldable screen technologies that's come around. And so, you know, you could, you know, have each button as it appears based on, you know, the whatever is happening underneath that layer, as far as the, you know, specific nodes that are being pressed up. You know, those could illuminate in the colors of the buttons. Those could, and so it looks like a controller when you're looking at it. You know, I think it would still feel a little bit squishier than just hitting kind of like an old fashioned button. But, you know, maybe I'm given a lot of hope by the way that the dual senses, the PlayStation 5 controller's dual senses triggers feel, and how, you know, it can apply some resistance to it to make it feel like you're really firing a gun, or like you're really, you know, pulling back on a rubber band or something like that. And, you know, there's some really, really cool and really creative stuff they've done with those triggers already. And it's only been out for like a week at this point. So, you know, presumably those types of technologies could be applied across the entire face of the controller. So, you know, each game can kind of decide, this is where I need each button to go. This is where I need the D-pad to go. This is, you know, maybe they can even introduce new buttons mid gameplay to trigger certain specific effects, you know. So, you know, I would love something that's very very adaptable, and but can still kind of feel like you're pressing a button, still has that responsiveness.
There's another sort of mechanism that I'm thinking of, and you almost see it in like, this is going to be a weird example, but do you own like a Swiffer at all at home?
Like those dusting things?
Either that or like the Swiffer mop, like the wet jet. So there's a kind of a mechanism, and this is in other things, I'm just struggling to think of them right now, but you kind of push in, some vacuums have this, you push in a bit of a pin, and then you can slide on another connector until the pin kind of pops through a hole. I'm wondering if there's like a possibility of having the right buttons on a bit of a rotating circle. So maybe there's two or three different rotation positions, almost like the top of a salt shaker, or a cheap salt shaker or something, where you can raise different buttons depending on the kind of pins that are back there. So you kind of rotate and then different buttons raise and collapse, and you can toggle between a few different variations of buttons.
Or you can almost like swap on different like face plates for your controller that have different button configurations. Obviously that requires more kind of printing of individual. It's like, you know, maybe each game would come with its own faceplate of different button layouts. It's not a super, I don't know, sustainable solution, like as far as, especially in the days of primarily digital game purchases. But I mean, it's an interesting idea.
One of the other, this blew me away, but have you heard of these? They're called UE Fits.
No, I don't know that.
This is a technology. I don't know if it applies to the buttons on the controller, but I think it could be some future concept of a very premium controller. But they are a very expensive pair of headphones. They're $250, and they ship with two ear kind of inner ear pieces that are filled with a gel. And the first thing you do when you get them is you take them out of the case and you push them into your ear and you activate a little UV light that's also baked into the headphone. And it sort of cures the gel so that the headphones stay in the shape of your ear. Imagine, I don't know if this is, again, applicable to buttons, but imagine being able to take a controller, you know, an Elite, a very premium controller out of the box. And the first phase of setup is like, you know, gently squeeze the controller with your hands and it cures the controller and, you know, truly in the shape of how you hold it.
Yeah, I feel like I've never really had a problem with the way the controllers feel. Maybe my hands are kind of the prototypical size.
You've got
built
the perfect
for.
Hands. That's what they call you.
But yeah, it's an interesting idea and like a way to really make it kind of tailor-made to, I mean, didn't the PlayStation 5 kind of promise that your 3D audio would be like specifically configured for your ears? Or was that just Mark Cerny talking about the technology and not something that was actually consumer facing.
Yeah, I think so. There was some concept of they scanned your ears or you can send in a scan of your, you know, it was one of those type of things. Mm-hmm. But in terms of going back to the buttons thing, what I do like potentially as well is, you know, buttons very often rely on labels that are baked onto the controller, right? So mm-hmm. if you have a scenario where the buttons have either very small OLED screens, you know, that technology will only get cheaper and cheaper, or even the buttons themselves are lit with some, you know, not too bright LED, and suddenly a game can not only just not only change the color of the buttons or potentially what the button says, but now you get a scenario where you could potentially have one button literally change the appearance of other buttons. So if you have scenarios where you have like a radial menu or something, or one button is kind of a modifier to a second button, you could do a lot of things with the display. Of course, challenges for colorblind and all that stuff should be accounted for. But yeah, it's like controllers. Almost all video games kind of count on the fact that a controller is kind of an unchanging thing.
Let's wrap that one up and let's give it a name.
This is like the true, this is the adaptive controller. If Microsoft didn't already have a great controller named the adaptive controller, it's something that can be reprogrammed.
I wonder if there's like a DualSense, DualShock type of controller setup we could use. If there's any word that begins with an S, you know,
is this dual stuff. The dual smart?
The dual smart. There we go. That's that thing that works out pretty well. All right, the dual smart.
Your old controller is dumb. That's what we'll play in the commercial.
We have a video game pitch from our community. This one comes from Zaintor, who says, "Greetings, HQ. I find it a little cringy and disappointing that you guys have to resort to spam for game pitch ideas.
I don't know what he's talking
about.
You
always come up with amazing content. I listened to Zippy's Fly Adventures today, and I'd play it too. All the same, I've put off sending ideas for far too long, so here's a couple of sample pitches to starve off the emergency spam grabs for a little while. First of all, yeah, thank you. Of course, we always do prefer reading pitches from actual humans from the community instead of spam, but I do think that like going into something that clearly isn't meant to be a video game pitch does present kind of an interesting challenge. And I think it really kind of puts the idea out there that like you can get inspiration from anywhere. So, you know, as far as like kind of the core tenets of what we started this podcast to do, like it still fits pretty well with our philosophy. So, but we appreciate you sending it in. This is always preferable, but you know, it's probably not going anywhere long term. The first is a name, Portal Combat. Yes, it's Portal meets Mortal Kombat. I think that will do it. We can save the second pitch for another time. Let's go ahead and start the clock.
Portal Combat. Portal Combat. So in this, in your mind, because Portal is such a 3D kind of go anywhere experience, do you imagine we should have similar navigation, like the ability to kind of run around in any direction?
Well, this is something that, you know, one aspect of portals that always seems, I mean, there's a lot of ways to make portals lethal, whether you move a portal while somebody's halfway through it. I guess that wouldn't be that bad, because then they would it cut them off at the waist, or would it just move their top half or bottom half to whatever the new location is? I guess that's interesting to think through as well. But you could also, I mean, obviously there's the kind of terminal velocity that you can very quickly reach by going through multiple portals. What if there's kind of a small arena cage match type of game where both of you have portal guns and you're basically trying to either kind of set up elaborate traps to kind of, you know, cause rocks to fall on your enemy or to cause them to get caught in a lethal portal trap or something, but basically a combat focused, you know, very small scale first person shooter where the only weapon that you have is a portal gun.
I like that. One of the things that makes me think of, if we were going to go to the Mortal Kombat phase of this and incorporate Mortal Kombat in some way, you don't necessarily have to, I know Mortal Kombat's primarily expressed through being able to be Scorpion, Sub-Zero, Katana, that sort of thing. But if you were kind of these, you know, outworld soldiers or you know, people who are not necessarily one of the main protagonists, but instead your portals could kind of, and now we have these next-gen consoles that could potentially pull this off with SSDs, opening up portals to just straight up different Mortal Kombat mm-hmm. levels, and you're constantly trying to get your opponent to step in acid or fall into the pit and, you know, onto spikes and that sort of thing.
Yeah, maybe this kind of 3D arena that you're in has a series of hazards. And so, you know, has an acid pit, it has spikes and stuff that you can use to your advantage. Maybe there's also, thinking back to Mortal Kombat, that famous stage where, you know, there's the bridge and then the moon in the background and the witch flies in front of the moon, and that allows you to fight kind of an extra character if you do everything right. You know, maybe there is a moon in the background kind of referencing back to the end of Portal 2. And as clouds move out of the way, you could potentially land a portal on the moon with very good precision, and then your exit portal, your, you know, your other portal, the one that isn't on the moon at that point, would become kind of like a, you know, kind of a swirling vacuum in a way. Makes that very very dangerous, but the risk is that, like, you know, clouds are always kind of partially obscuring the moon. It's kind of hard to hit in the first place. If you're looking up at the moon, that's time that you're not spent looking at what's around you and trying to kind of follow where your opponent is. If one of your portals is on the moon, that means that you can't use both portals for two portal types of activities. You can't use it to escape anywhere. If you accidentally shoot another portal too close to yourself, then you might pull yourself into the vacuum. There's a lot of, like, good trade-offs there that could make a potentially very deadly move also very risky.
You know, Portal was so tightly designed, and I do think one thing to create another layer of chaos in this is to have some control, some mechanism where you can actually shoot a portal almost Rick and Morty style. Like, if you can just pin it at the right angle on the ground, it would be like a freestanding portal kind of in the middle of the arena.
Okay.
So, because what I'm thinking is, like, you know, for better or worse, I'm picturing a circular, almost Mortal Kombat from Nintendo 64 era, round Mortal Kombat combat arena, and the ability to, like, stand up these portals, and maybe even as you fire off portals, it's on some kind of rotation, so you have a chance of, like, oh, you accidentally shot a portal, it opened up a dimension where, you know, Reptile is, and Reptile steps through the portal for a second, and you have to avoid him, like, spitting acid and going invisible and stuff on you as you continue to try and, you know, portal your opponent to death, if you will.
Yeah, so definitely kind of setting this within the Mortal Kombat universe, then, that's kind of where we're landing here.
No, I mean, it did say Portal in Mortal Kombat, but I could be down with whatever.
So there are several characters in Mortal Kombat that can use portals themselves to potentially travel through time. There's some weird stuff that happens in some of the later Mortal Kombat games.
Yeah,
I'm just trying to think of, like, all the fun ways that there's a character in Mortal Kombat 11 who has kind of like combat shields, like a energy shields that she can deploy. And then, you know, in her fatalities, she uses those to kind of, like, slice enemies in half. You know, I'd love to find ways to make kind of interesting fatalities, interesting, you know, ways to dissect and bisect enemies, maybe even cutting off individual limbs, kind of like a Dead Space style. Just make, you know, this type of, you know, playing with portals feel deadly again.
What if we did something where, talking a little risk v reward here for a second, what if beings from one of these otherworldly places, and your bodies can't actually survive in any of these realms that you're not supposed to be in for a very long period of time? So you are actually forced to continuously move through portals to kind of reset your life timer, and whoever gets trapped, you know, in a place is the person who ends up dying or losing health or whatever. But now you kind of get into a situation where you want to step through your enemy's portals. You can't travel through your own portals potentially, and you kind of have to be stepping through what your enemy's doing, but then you layer in like Mortal Kombat special moves. Maybe each player can use a button combination on our new dual smart controller and cast like a portal that is going to, when you step through it, freeze you for a second, or an unstable portal. So it goes, you know, pop, 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 pop. And if you don't like step through it in the right moment, it's like an Indiana Jones trap and you know, you lose an arm or something.
Yeah. So what other kind of fun ways can we use? What kind of traps can we set for other people using portal technology? Obviously something can fall on them. You can dump them into, you know, a dangerous pit. But like what kind of really creative things can we use to trap or to, you know, impale like, you know, other characters?
I like the idea of being able to cast like a false portal or like a mirage portal that, mm-hmm, if you don't really look at it before you step through it, potentially you're stepping right into lava or something. So there's this kind of quick read and deceit going on there.
It's like a Wile E. Coyote type of thing.
I like that you hang around in the air for a second.
Okay, let's see.
I like the idea of also like the ability to quickly retract a portal. So if you can cast a portal right at the edge of the stage, try and get the person to step through it and then very quickly pull it away as they approach it. Once they're in it, you can't do anything, but if you can get it right before they step in, you can yank it away and have them fall to their death. Just this idea of like somebody else is in control of the exit that you need.
All right. I think that will do it for that one. We have a name, Portal Combat. I think that still fits pretty well. So thank you very much, Zaintor, for sending that in. And we'll catch your next pitch again next week. If anyone else has a pitch that they would like to send in, then they can do so by emailing us, playwrightcast@gmail.com. You can go to playwrightcast.com/pitch. Or you can tweet us at PlayWrightCast.
Special thank you to Protodome for the use of our theme song, Gobble Gobble Hello World, of the album Blue Noise. It's really just Hello World, but you've heard me say that a million times. When you're listening to shows this Thanksgiving, and you're not a sports ball person who wants to sit there and watch people get concussions on the TV, you can go and spend your time listening to great video game content like Sound of Play and The Sausage Factory and the Kane and Rince podcast.
Take us out of the show today. I believe you are bringing a redacted game.
We've had a bit of a losing streak, and I feel like this one is within your grasp. See Redacted 100 years before Redacted and experience the events of the Redacted. Join the struggle that brought Redacted to its knees. Learn more about Redacted, the Redacted, the Redacted, and more through dramatic cutscenes as they try to save the Redacted from Redacted. The Redacted game is the only way to firsthand see what happened 100 years ago. Battle hordes of Redacted, most formidable foes. Redacted to towering Redacted. Redacted's troops have emerged in Redacted.
All right, I feel pretty confident about this one.
Oh, damn it. I was really hoping that that wouldn't be the case. I thought I was get you know, at least some drama out of this, but go ahead.
This is Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 2.
Well, easy, you nailed it.
Skating through, you know, various 100-year rifts to challenge the hordes of Bam Margera and his minions. No, would this be tomorrow's release of Hyrule Warriors Age of Calamity?
You are absolutely right.
All right.
Well done. I was really hoping to get to the point where you asked me for a 0 and a 10 review because I was going to tell you none exist.
Yeah. Oh, so it's not a very popular game. One that went vastly overlooked.
That's right. That's right. It's the number 74 best game of its platform in 2020. What a title.
Oh, very, well, sorry to be a little anticlimactic there, but I guess I have that one on the mind. I have it preloaded on my Switch and I'm just waiting for those hours to click down so I can start playing some Hyrule Warriors again.
2020
actually,
is
we talked a couple weeks ago that you got into the classic Hyrule Warriors.
It's still sitting on the Switch. I haven't tried it yet.
Okay, I haven't tried it yet.
I haven't tried it yet. I haven't tried it since the Wii U days. I did play it a little bit back then, but I haven't given it a go on Switch yet.
Okay, well, I'm still curious to kind of hear what you make of that one.
I'm going to go to how long to beat. How long to beat that game, do you think?
You can get through the story fairly quickly. The Switch version has like 3 story modes attached to it. So it's a little bit beefier than it used to be, but like story mode isn't that much time, but it's also a very small amount of the content. Like the adventure maps are really like you rush through the story so you can get to the adventure maps, which is where the real meat of the game is. You don't even unlock all the characters and weapons through the story mode.
Yeah, I won't even, is that what you said?
Yeah, so, you know, you don't see all of the game's content by playing through the story. So
are you ready for this time quote
that,
here?
You know, the goal.
Main story, 16 hours. Main plus extra, 35 and a half hours. And then the completionist quote here, 376 hours. It's mental.
I mean, I have personally, between all of the versions, probably spent 300 hours on Hyrule Warriors, but like,
wow.
I think you could, that's ultra completionist. Like, there is probably that much to do in the game, but like, you stop unlocking, novel new things after about 120 hours probably, but like that's really if you are putting the time in, you know.
Gosh, Hyrule Warriors, who knew? So much content.
Yeah, good game, and excited for the sequel. It comes out tomorrow as of the time of recording, so by the time that we record our next show I will have played it, and we'll be either very excited about the additional kind of post-story content to get to, or very disappointed that it strayed so far from the original I spent so much time with. Guess we'll find out.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Yeah, go spend some time, probably not with your families. That's probably not advisable this year, but, at least, give them a call. Tell them you say hi.
Give them a call, Google chat them, FaceTime them. Just whatever you do, do not go out on Black Friday. This is what the internet was made for. Just order your stuff.
Yeah.
It'll come right to you.
Order your PS5 from the safety of your home in any number of 3-second increments scattered throughout the day.
As long as you beat the sneaker bots, they can't control you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll catch you again next week.
Bye.